From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Dennis Hopper. His new movie, Carried Away, offers a departure from the villain roles he's associated with. He plays a school teacher in a small rural community who has an affair with a student. We'll talk with Hopper about his new film and about the movies, music, and art that have most affected him over the years. Also today, French filmmaker Bertrand Tavernier tells us about the Lumière brothers, the Frenchmen who invented the cinema just over 100 years ago. Tavernier is head of the Lumière Institute in France and is touring with a show of Lumière films. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Columbia Records and its new album releases, Dead Man Walking, music from and inspired by the motion picture, and the companion piece, Dead Man Walking, the score. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I can think of few people who are better at playing twisted villains than Dennis Hopper, but in his new movie, he gets to do something different. In Carried Away, Hopper plays Joseph Svendon, a schoolteacher in a small rural community who lives on a broken-down farm with his dying mother. He's introspective and reserved and walks with a limp as a result of a childhood tractor accident. For several years, he's been romantically involved with a widow who was his childhood sweetheart, played by Amy Irving. But he's never ready to commit to marriage. Everything changes when a beautiful 17-year-old girl, played by Amy Locane, arrives in town and becomes his student. She also boards her horse in his barn. In that barn, she takes off her clothes and tries to seduce him. He walks away. But before he gets very far, he returns. Here's Hopper and Locane in a scene after that first sexual encounter.
What are you thinking about?
That I never made love with a student before.
Does it bother you?
I don't know. I think it would bother me more if it had been your first time. I don't think it was it?
No. I've been with other guys.
I see. Did you enjoy yourself?
With them or with you?
I deserve that.
Well, let's just say that you're the best so far.
Your character has an affair with a 17-year-old girl who's his high school student, a girl who's just moved into the community, and she comes on strong to him. Do you feel like you would understand what would lead him to give in to his own physical desire when he, through his life, has been, in many ways, a man of great restraint and some inhibition?
No, I understand it. I think it would be difficult to understand, and if he didn't respond to her, I think that would be very strange. But I'm not saying that it's correct, that it's right, wrong, good, or bad. I just I certainly understand his going for the lustful moment that he goes for.
There's a really nice scene where you're sitting at a lunch counter after the first time you've made love with this high school student, and your character's the doctor of your character's mother walks in, accompanied by the town priest or reverend, and just like a chill comes over you. You could just see on your face, like, boy, here's like God's representative who's just who's just walked in right after you've committed this act of sinful lust, and although you know your character thinks that there's something acceptable about this, he's also really deeply disturbed by the whole thing.
Oh, no, he is. It's never happened to him before. Yeah. He doesn't understand what's happening. But at the same time, I think he finds himself involved in what he thinks is a D.H. Lawrence romantic novel suddenly. Mm-hmm. I mean, here's a well-read man, even though he's landlocked and has had very little experience. Suddenly this opens up a whole world to him of sensual delights, if nothing more. And suddenly his life becomes alive again. And then that affects his relationship with Amy Irving, who he's refused to marry, who he's been having an affair with for years, but because she had married his best friend when they were young rather than him. And then his friend went off and they had a child, and his friend went off and was killed in the war. He's never really forgiven the Amy Irving character. So this brings them together, and he at one point says to her, you know, we've been making love for 6 years, but I've never ever seen you with the lights on. I've never ever seen you naked. And it's a scene where I suddenly start taking my clothes off in the middle of her kitchen.
Do you want to describe the scene?
Well, do you remember the scene?
I'm actually trying to remember exactly which scene it is. I think it's when the doctor walks in on you, right?
No, I come in out of the rain, and I wake up Amy Irving in the middle of the night, and I've been drinking.
Okay, I was thinking.
And she says, what's the matter with you? You're going to wake up the whole household. And I say, I think I've got the flu. And she says something about, I think you've had the flu for, you know, a year now or something. And I said, well, maybe I'm going through a change of life. You know, men go through a change of life. They find at a certain age that they haven't done the things that they thought that they would be able to in their lives, and they go through a change of life. And she says, what could you possibly want to do with your life besides screw a movie star? And I said, well, I'd like to go fishing. I'd like to sit alone. I'd like to read a book. I'd like to do this and so on. And I'd like to make love to you, you know, with the lights on, you know. And so finally I end up saying, do I look so bad because I'm a cripple? And I start taking my clothes. It looks so bad you have to hide me in the dark. And I end up standing nude. Eventually she goes and pours herself a drink. And she comes back and I convince her to take her clothes off. And we make love in the kitchen. But it's a very sweet, very complicated, wonderful movie about adult love and adult problems.
Yeah. Dennis Hopper is my guest, and he stars in the new movie Carried Away. You grew up in Dodge City, Kansas. At least that's where you spent the early years of your life. Did any of the characters in the movie remind you of anyone you knew growing up?
Oh, yeah. Well, my great uncles, they wore bib overalls. They rotted off of them. They were wheat, they were wheat farmers. I used to milk the cow before I went to school in the morning, so...
Were there big town scandals when you were growing up?
Well, I mean, Dodge City was, we're still trying to live up to the old days when Bat Masterson and Doc Holliday and Wyatt Earp were there, you know. I just remember it was a dry state, but if you're old enough to get your hand up on a bar, they'd put a drink in it. So,
you know, really?
And fighting around the drive-ins seemed to be, and not the drive-in movies, but the drive-in hamburger joints seemed to be the big thing to do after football games. And I, you know, my mother managed a swimming pool in Dodge City, Kansas, so I had an active swimming life as a child, and my grandfather's a wheat farmer, so it was a good life.
Was it fun to see movies about Dodge City living there?
Well, I remember Errol Flynn came to Dodge City when I was about 5 years old. That was a big time for the premiere of I think it was called Dodge City, I think, for Fort Dodge or whatever it was. It was a movie that Errol Flynn starred in with Olivia de Havilland. And anyway, they came there. That probably had a lot to do with me eventually wanting to be an actor, I think.
Was that the only connection you saw between the movie world and your own life?
Well, I mean, I was raised at the end of the Dust Bowl, so I used to tell people the first light that I really saw was not from the sun, but it was from a movie projector. Yeah. My grandmother used to, she didn't drive a car, so she used to fill her apron. We lived about 5 miles outside of Dodge, and so my grandfather would go off to the farm in Garden City, which is 60 miles away. My grandmother would fill her eggs full of apron on Saturday mornings.
Fill her apron full of eggs?
Yeah, and we'd walk into town. She'd sell the eggs at the poultry place and get the money. We'd go to see a matinee, and I'd see the Singing Cowboys. Once in a while, we'd see an Errol Flynn movie or a sword-buckling movie. That's about it. I don't really remember what they were, but I knew I wanted to know where they were making these movies, and Kansas was a very flat place, so I wanted to know where the trains were going and what a mountain looked like, what a skyscraper looked like, what the ocean looked like. And years later, I thought that I think it's one of the reasons I became so interested in the visual aspects of things, because that horizon line, when I finally saw the ocean when I was 13 years old, I saw my first mountain when I came to Colorado when I was 13 on the way to California. I was really disappointed. My mountains that I'd imagined were so much bigger. And I got to California and I saw the ocean. It was the same horizon line that I'd seen on the wheat field. And I thought, wow, this is not what I'd imagined, you know. I don't know what I thought. I thought you could see all the way to China or something, or it looked different. It'd be a different angle. But it was the same horizon line. And I think that then I saw my first skyscraper, and not as big as I'd imagined. I always thought that, like, my imagination had been developed quite... was a little out of whack, you know. My buildings were bigger, my mountains were bigger, and the ocean was bigger in my imagination than in reality. So,
well, when you started taking photographs, did you want the size of buildings and the size of mountains to be as big as they had been in your memory from movies, or did you want them to be as real as reality was, even though that was often disappointing?
Yeah, well, you know, what I did was I became an actor when I was 18 years. I started acting at the Old Globe Theater in San Diego when I was 13, and doing Shakespeare and doing all that. So when I was 18 years old, I moved from I moved from San Diego to Los Angeles, and in a short amount of time, I got a contract at Warner Brothers. I was still 18 years old. I just graduated from high school, and I was now under contract to Warner Brothers, and I was doing Rebel Without a Cause. And when I was 19, I did Giant with Rock Hudson, Elizabeth Taylor, and James Dean. So during that period of time, everybody was photographing me. So when I started taking photographs, which was in this period of time, I'd already been a painter. And I started taking photographs, not of people, but of walls and of things where I had no depth of field. I would shoot flat on, so I had a painting surface. So I'd shoot flat on a wall or flat on something, and it would become like the surface of a painting. So that was my early beginnings of photography in the early 50s. And then I went through a Cartier-Bresson decisive moment period when I when I came to study with Lee Strasberg in New York, which is where you catch something in action. Guy's throwing a ball, it's just before he catches the ball, or somebody's walking over a puddle, which is a famous thing. He's got his foot up just before his foot hits the water, or whatever. It's a moment where you see with a still camera when to push the shutter and when to catch that decisive moment that will make it a photograph. So I went through a period of that when I was in New York. And then a friend of mine, because I was hanging around art galleries, you know, some people went to the beach and became beach bums, and some became tennis bums, some became ski bums. I became an art gallery bum, and I just hung around art galleries because there were so many people involved in making movies, so many different departments and everything, that I thought an artist, a painter, a solitary kind of creator that could create by himself, that was more interesting to me than all the people around movies. You know, so many people, so many creative people involved in making a movie.
Now, I want to back up just for one second. When you were going through your decisive moment period as a photographer, mm-hmm. what were a couple of the decisive moments that you click the shutter for?
Oh, dear. Well, I mean, through the time of my career of taking photographs, I was a lot of different places. I was at the free speech movement in Berkeley. I was at the hippie love-ins. I marched with Martin Luther King through the South. I was a student. I was in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. You know, I was at the March on Washington and Selma to Montgomery and all those things. So I covered, in that decisive moment period, I covered everything from attack dogs and, you know, biting us to a flower being handed to Martin Luther King, you know, by a young girl.
My guest is Dennis Hopper. He's starring in the new movie Carried Away. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Back with actor Dennis Hopper, he's also a painter, photographer, and art collector. Now, what was your first exposure to art? Was there any art around when you were growing up? And I'd even be interested in hearing if your parents or grandparents had, you know, tacky, kitschy things that they decorated the house with.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I drew when I was a kid, and I studied at the Nelson Art Gallery on weekends. They had an underprivileged children's art class.
Were you an underprivileged child?
Well, I got in there. Yeah, I was. I slipped in. So at that time, I was in a drawing class, and I was doing a little watercolor like I'd learned in Dodge City. And this man came up to me, and he said, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm painting this rock and river and so on. And he said, well, son, he said, I don't know how to tell you this, but someday you're going to have to get tight and paint loose. Yeah. And this man was, God, I'm trying to think of his name, kind of just slipped his name right out. But he was Jackson Pollock's teacher. He was, oh God, this is going to drive me crazy. Thomas Hart Benton. Thomas Hart Benton, yeah. He taught me, taught Pollock. Anyway, I studied there, and I found that I would go into the theater and draw the actors.
The movie theater or stage theater?
Stage theater, mm-hmm. Where they were rehearsing plays, and I'd sketch the actors and So that was sort of my beginning of my art career. And when I arrived in Los Angeles, I had worked at the La Jolla Playhouse, and my friend who was my boss there, he was an interior designer, and he was working with Mary Price, Vincent Price's wife, who was an interior designer. They had a kiln where they did tile work at Vincent's house, and I went up there and made some tiles. And that's where I saw, Vincent was an art collector, and that's where I saw my first friends, Klein, my first Jackson Pollocks, my first de Koonings, and so on, were at his house. And I'd been painting abstractly, but I'd never really thought that anybody really painted abstractly until I saw these things. And so I started doing work, and I started showing with the painters around at that time. As a matter of fact, Ed Keenholz, who has a big retrospective right now at the Whitney Museum, was one of the artists that I worked with.
Now, it must have been interesting to be exposed to your first abstract art through somebody's private collection as opposed to through a museum.
Yeah.
Did that, in a way encourage you to later become a collector? I mean, because it was part of how you were first exposed to it. I know you collect a lot of art.
Yeah. Well, Vincent gave me a painting, actually, when I was about, I was 19 or 20. Vincent gave me small painting, I don't even remember who it was by now. Mm-hmm. And I said, I know that that you're probably going to be a collector, so let me start you off.
Gee, how nice.
And then when I got my first money, I did start collecting art. And it's like a compulsion. I was thinking about the other day, I think that, you know, I don't have a formula where I go to the right dealer and buy the right painting. I've been very fortunate to seemed to have an eye. I bought Andy Warhol's first soup can painting, hand painted for $70.
When was it?
That was like 1963, I believe.
Why did you want it? What spoke to you about the painting? What did it?
The first time America had an art form of its own was abstract expressionism. We'd always imitated the Europeans before that, and rather than drawing a mountain and saying, I'm not going to draw a mountain, or I'm going to draw a tree, or I'm going to draw this wonderful face of this person. Abstract expressionist says, we're going to use paint as paint. We're not going to draw anything. We're going to make a brush stroke, and that's going to be the painting. And it's going to be action. It's going to be done with action. So we're not going to have time to think and preconceive a lot of stuff. We're just going to use our motion and use the action of painting itself and make that become the design and the pattern and the motion of the canvas and so on. So this changed the whole way that everybody looked at art, and America suddenly had its own art form. And after you get into second and third generation, there's usually about 12 or 13 people who form the nucleus of a group. I mean, in the abstract expressions, there was Jackson Pollock and Franz Klein and de Kooning and Gottlieb and, I don't know, I guess, there's Motherwell. And there were about 10 or 12 guys and women. That's sort of the way it's been through the history of art, through Dada and Surrealism. And they just suddenly crop up, and all these people are suddenly painting abstractly. They didn't have a meeting somewhere and said, let's all paint abstractly. But for some reason, they followed the history of art, and the next step seems to have been obvious to them, and they start doing it.
As somebody who was so attracted to abstraction, what interested you in the idea of something representational, of a little commercial object?
That's
like
what I'm really, I know I'm beating around the bush, that's what I'm trying to get to. So at a certain point, if you're collecting art or involved in it, you suddenly see the third generation people are now imitating. It's like looking at Remington or Russell, the great Western painters, and suddenly now you see Western artists imitating those things. It's not original anymore, it's just an imitation. Well, when you have an original art form like abstract expressionism, you get third generation abstract expressionists imitating the first ones and trying to find their own way. The critics started talking about, what is the return to reality going to be? When are we going to return to reality? Now, at that time, there was a group of painters in San Francisco called the Bay Area Figurative Painters, and there was David Parks and Elmer Bischoff and Richard Diebenkorn and Nathan Oliveira, whatever. And they were using abstract expressionist terms, and they were going back and using the figure. And I looked at this, and I said, no, this is good painting, but this has already been done. So Tien had done this before in France, before abstract expressionism. This couldn't be the return to reality, because they're using old forms to return to reality. It doesn't make sense to me. So when I saw my first soup can painting, and I saw my first by Andy Warhol, and I saw my first cartoon paintings by Roy Lichtenstein, and I saw the billboard paintings of Rosenquist, and I saw Oldenburg's giant hamburgers and so on, I realized that this was the return to reality, that this was the comic book and the soup can and the Coca-Cola bottle of Jasper Johns and so on, Rauschenberg, and these guys were coming back to reality with a whole new set of things. I mean, before pop art, as we know it, popular art, commercial art, came into being, the largest lithograph was just a 2-foot by 3-foot piece of paper. Then suddenly we could use, there was Rosenquist, and suddenly we could do what commercial art could do. We can make lithographs the size of billboards, and Ed Keenhall showed us that we could take things off the wall and we could make rooms and environment, and Rosenquist took the square and the rectangle and broke the surface for the first time in 1961, and suddenly we had different shaped canvases, and suddenly there was hard edge, and it went on and on, and it was a wonderful, wonderful life I've had in art, because I've seen so many different things happen and develop.
Dennis Hopper stars in the new movie Carried Away. He'll be back with us in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Harper San Francisco, publisher of the illustrated World's Religions by religion historian Houston Smith. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Dennis Hopper. Also, a look back at the birth of the cinema just over 100 years ago. We talk with French director Bertrand Tavernier, who's touring with a show of the first movies to be projected on a screen, movies by the Lumière brothers. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dennis Hopper. He stars in the new movie Carried Away. In addition to acting, Hopper is a photographer, painter, and art collector. He started collecting art in about 1963 at a time when he'd been acting in a lot of TV shows, like Sugarfoot, Wagon Train, The Rifleman, Cheyenne, Naked City, and The Defenders. I asked him if he was living in two different worlds.
It was strange because I was doing what I consider sophisticated work. As an actor.
As an actor, yeah.
But at the same time, and the television at the time was very formula kind of stuff. But I'd also been in Rebel Without a Cause,
right.
Which was sort of a far out flick of the day and very successful. I'd done a film called Night Tide, which we'd made for $25,000, Curtis Harrington and I, and we'd shot it in the streets and. It became in the Cinematheque in Paris, and it was well received. But we couldn't get it distributed because we'd made it non-union. So I was doing this television, starring in these television shows, but I was also living this other life. I was helping Andy Warhol make his first films, which is totally had nothing to do with any kind of professional kind of thing, but just sort of setting up a camera and watching the Empire State Building and reloading the film every
I had no idea you were a part of that. So you work with Paul Morrissey and Andy Warhol?
Yeah, in the very, very beginnings of it. I did his first film with him called Tarzan and Jane Revisited, which he shot out in Los Angeles. Andy had his first shows in Los Angeles and Roy Lichtenstein. They didn't have them in New York. They were shown at the Ferris Gallery in Los Angeles.
Huh.
And a lot of this was because Marcel Duchamp had the only retrospective he had in his life was in California in 1963. At the Pasadena Museum, a friend of mine, Walter Hopps, gave him a retrospective there. So it brought all the artists out from New York and around the world to Los Angeles suddenly.
No, Marcel Duchamp, did you read his diaries, his journals?
No, I never did, but I knew him.
You knew Marcel Duchamp?
Yeah.
How'd you meet him?
Well, I met him at his retrospective.
At the retrospective?
Yeah, all of us sort of did.
You didn't play chess with him, did you?
Actually, I did.
You
yeah,
did?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not for very long.
So
it was really good.
What was it like to play chess with Marcel Duchamp? I mean, there's like, John Cage has talked about that too, about how he loved to play chess with Duchamp. That was a big thing for Duchamp.
Well, it was, listen, I sat down at a table with him for about 3 minutes. It was a thrill, okay?
Right,
but
right,
I don't know
right.
what moves I made or what he
right,
did, except that I was thrilled by it. And that was the same day he was playing. There's a famous photograph of him sitting with playing chess with a nude. And that was in Pasadena.
Dennis Hopper is my guest, and he's starring in the new movie Carried Away. Dennis Hopper, in addition to being an actor, is a photographer and painter and art collector. You've been collecting art for a long time. I think it was in, 1961 that your home burned down in a fire.
In the Bel Air fire. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, did that discourage you from collecting? Because you lost, well, I don't know exactly what you lost, but I imagine just about everything you own. Though I know your photographs had been touring and had been in an exhibition, so they were saved. But,
yeah.
I mean, I think a lot of people would think, well, what's the point of collecting when objects you own can be so ephemeral.
Yeah, well, I lost over 300 of my own paintings. I had a studio in the garage, so it all burnt down, so I lost all my paintings. I did have a photographic show that night that opened, so my negatives from my photographs are saved. In the house itself, I was married to Brooke Hayward. All I had really at that time, my ex-wife Brooke lost all of her mother's, Margaret Sullivan's, furniture that she had in the house. And my father had fought with Mao across China. He was in the OSS, Office of Strategic Services, and he had been one of the people that took the surrender from the Japanese in Peiping and then left them armed till Chiang Kai-shek could come and take over so that Mao didn't take the country so quickly. However, he did collect some things when he had this three-month period of time that he was going back between Mao and the Japanese to get some artifacts out of China, and he bought these beautiful tapestries and things that he'd brought back from the Second World War. Unfortunately, I lost all those in that fire. And when I came out of the thing, the only painting that my wife had at the time was a Milton Avery, and the only thing that I saved out of the house was the Milton Avery. I carried it out on my back as the house was burning down. So it gave us an opportunity, you know, when you lose everything, you have to start over again. And at that time is when I started collecting. I had some money to, like, start collecting, and I started buying pop art. Well, I fell into it right at that moment. I saw my first Soup Can painting. I saw my first Lichtensteins. And I bought a Soup Can, and I bought an Ed Keenholz, which was he's at the Whitney now, if anybody's interested in seeing his retrospective. But he was an assemblage artist, and there was a mannequin. It was called the Quickie, and it was a mannequin, woman's mannequin head on a roller skate, and she had her arm up, and she was picking her nose. It was called the Quickie. And so I bought that. And I bought that for $30 or something. And then I bought a big abstract wood relief, black and white relief, that Keenholz had also done for, I think that was $75. Uh-huh. My agent came in and looked at these things, a Soup Can painting, this mannequin on a roller skate picking her nose, and this big wood black and white construction abstract thing. And he said, You're wasting your life. You're wasting your money, your wife's money, and your money. And and if you don't stop this foolishness, you're going to have to look for another agent.
Wow.
And that's when my agent and I parted, and I went on collecting. So it's funny enough.
My guest is actor and art collector Dennis Hopper. He's starring in the new movie Carried Away. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Dennis Hopper.
Now, Dennis Hopper, can I talk with you about music a little bit? Has music
sure.
played an important part in your life? Do you like music a lot, listen a lot?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You grew up in your early years before rock and roll. What did you listen to before rock and roll?
Marie, the dawn is breaking. Marie, my heart is aching. You know, something like that.
So this is the era of the Four Freshmen. Who am I thinking of? The Four Aces.
Right, exactly.
Harry Como, Patti Page. Could you tell the good from the bad then? I mean, was there a difference to you between, say, you know, Patti Page and Ella Fitzgerald?
It's a big, wide, wonderful world. Really? Yeah. No, I could. I didn't know. Listen, I was having enough problems just trying to get through high school.
was there anything you loved out of all that period of pre-rock and roll pop?
Well, I when I got to Los Angeles when I was 18, this is like 1954, I got into jazz right away.
Uh-huh.
So there was a period of there before rock and roll. I'm not sure of the years, but there was a period of time there where jazz was king, and Miles Davis was the greatest act in the country, and Bob Rafelson said to me once, who was the creator of the Monkees, and later went on to do Five Easy Pieces with Jack Nicholson and so on, and make some wonderful films. But at the time, he said, if Miles Davis hadn't turned his back on the audience, the Beatles would never have been able to invade this country so easily. But Miles would only blow at a certain point when he felt like it. And so he would go out and just stand there and not maybe go through a whole concert. I've seen him go through whole concerts where he didn't blow at all and did make some fans angry. But I still love jazz. And rock and roll was something that I listened to secretly on the radio. I had a channel. I would move it to the rock and roll station. But even my wife, when she got in, I would change it to classical or change it to popular or change it to something. I didn't want anybody to know that I was listening to rock and roll.
Man. Why
it was
not?
Like animal music. You're not supposed to be listening to it. And this was a condition that went on for some time. And by one time my wife got in the car and started the car before I changed the station. It was playing rock and roll. I said, oh, I love rock and roll. I said, you do? Yeah. Big surprise, huh? Oh, wow.
You might be one of the few adults who had to hide rock and roll.
Yeah, well, it was strange, you know. It was a strange time. It's like, it's easy to accept pop art, and it's easy to accept abstract expressionist art most places these days. But in the old days, if you had an abstract painting, that was really weird. And if you had a soup can or a cartoon hanging in your house, I mean, who were you? What kind of weird person were you? And listening to rock and roll was like listening to the jungle or something. It just was unheard of. I mean, it was not accepted.
Now television, as we mentioned, you were doing a lot of episodic television in the, late 50s,
mm-hmm.
early
mm-hmm.
60s.
Yeah.
When did television come into your life? Not as an actor, but as a viewer.
Oh, as a viewer. I saw my first television show when I was 13.
That's pretty old.
Same year as I saw The Mountains. Yeah, well, I was like, how old was I? What year would it have been? 40.
Right.
Be about 1949, something
yeah.
like that.
So it was pretty early in TV's development.
Yeah.
Were you shocked by it?
I wasn't shocked by it. It was a miracle.
Yeah.
It was black and white and I think Kukla, Fran, and Ollie were the big show of the day. You know? Pretty exciting stuff. It was in California when I went to visit my aunt in California. So,
What about the best shows to do when you were acting in episodic television? I saw you in the pilot of The Rifleman. You know, they were maybe they still are rerunning it on the Family Channel.
Wow.
It's a really great series. And the episode you're in, you're like the kind of kid gunslinger who comes into town. And
you know,
you're a real show-off in it.
Sam Peckinpah wrote the pilot for
Yeah, well, he wrote and directed Rifleman. A lot of them.
Yeah. He didn't direct it, but he wrote it. But he was there on the set telling me how to play the part. So. But Sam and I had known each other for years. He was the only guy I knew that smoked grass besides me.
Huh.
So we could hide together on the studio lots and smoke a joint every once in a while.
Just one question about marijuana and other drugs. Do you think that they affected your visual sensibility at all, or your artistic interests?
Well, you know, first of all, I'm in these 12-step programs because I had a problem. You know, I became a drug addict and mm-hmm. alcoholic. So I'm sort of torn with this question. I think that I don't think anyone needs them
mm-hmm.
to enhance their visual or intellectual capacities. Does it help? It might in the beginning open up some doors, you know, but those doors rapidly close if you're a drug addict. And it's not a way of seeing, it's a way of dying. And that's a reality. As far as drinking, I mean, being an alcoholic and a drug addict, it was so easy for me to point to, because I'm an artist, after all, it's okay for me to drink and take drugs because I have an excuse. And being in total denial about the fact that you're an alcoholic and drug addict, because after all, Van Gogh spent a whole summer of drinking to find that yellow. And then at the end of it, I say, well, yeah, he probably couldn't find the tube the yellow was in. He was so drunk. Yeah. But you justify all these things, and it's too easy to justify using drugs and drinking because you're an artist. And I can't cop to that excuse. I can say, yes, in the beginning, everything works. Sex works, drugs works, everything works. If you go too far with it, it becomes less effective, and then you start working for it rather than it working for you.
Right.
And some of the greatest artists of all time never drank and never took drugs, and that's a reality as much as it is a reality that there a lot of them did, and a lot of them died painfully stupid lives, which they could have been avoided if they hadn't drank and taken drugs.
I really want to thank you a lot for talking with us about your new movie and about art and stuff.
Well, it's always a pleasure. It's great listening to your show.
Dennis Hopper stars in the new movie, Carried Away. You may know the French film director Bertrand Tavernier for his movies Round Midnight and A Sunday in the Country. In France, he's also known as one of the country's experts on American film. And he heads the Lumière Institute, which preserves the legacy of the Lumière brothers, who created the cinema just over 100 years ago. In celebration, Tavernier is touring America, screening some of the Lumière brothers' movies. The Lumières didn't invent the moving picture. There were already kinescopes, little boxes which you looked into to see your short movie. But the Lumières were the first to project a moving picture onto a screen. They were also the first to put a camera on the street and shoot the people passing by. I asked Bertrand Tavernier to describe what the Lumières invented that made it possible to project a movie onto a screen.
invented a process which was in which the film were could roll, I mean, in the camera, could with the perforation. And that system, I mean, the idea of that system came to him, according to maybe a legend, during a night of insomnia, where he thought of the sewing machine. And in fact, he adapted the system on the sewing machine on the camera. And he invented a camera which was very light, 4 kilos, and which was able to shoot, to process, to develop, and to project. The same camera could do the three operations.
It's amazing. What, if anything, did the developing technology keep from the Lumière's technology?
They kept many things. I mean, the way the film is rolling.
The sprockets, the idea of sprockets.
Yeah, the sprocket. I mean, the idea. It's
that's from the Lumière's.
That's from the Lumière, and what they kept, I think, was the idea of Lumière, which was an incredible idea for a bourgeois from Lyon, rather conservative, which was to send some operators and cameramen throughout the world. I mean, in New York, in Moscow, in China, in Australia, in Argentina. I mean, to film the daily life, the street. Do you imagine that in Bombay or in Buenos Aires, 6 months after the invention of cinema, people were able to see films about a New York street, a London street, some comedies taking place in France, a train coming into a station in the south of France. I mean, the idea is so great. I mean, and the film are so beautiful. The film, the beauty of the film, because Louis Lumière was a great, great, great director.
I think one of the Lumière's most famous films is of a train arriving at a station. Yeah. What was the film like, and what impact did it have when audiences first saw it?
When we presented it in our program, we said that was the first horror film.
The first what?
Horror film. Yes. Uh-huh. People were very frightened.
They thought the train was going to run
them
over.
Yes, they start to yell. But what is interesting now is where the camera is put, that the sense of perspective, because we get a sense of movement. We get there is an opposition between the black and the white, the framing of that film, and has many, many films of Lumière, is totally striking and totally modern.
I think each of the Lumière films was, what, about a minute long?
50 seconds. 17 meters, 50 seconds.
And that was just the amount of film that they were able to shoot, process, and project within
that was
the camera.
Coming from Edison. That was, it's only, I mean, the can could only contain that at that time. Later on, around after 1900, they were 10 or 15 seconds longer.
How many of these are still in existence?
The Lumière shot 1,500 films. 1,427 are preserved.
Including the one of the train?
Yes, including the one on the train, and including some which are totally unknown, which are shot in Vietnam or in Japan or in Spain, which are absolutely beautiful. I mean, there are some of them. There is one shot in Vietnam with the camera in a rickshaw, which is one of the most moving films I've ever seen in my life.
My guest is French film director Bertrand Tavernier, who heads the Lumière Institute in France. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back.
back with French film director Bertrand Tavernier.
You are the head of the Lumière Institute.
Yes.
You're not only interested in preserving the past of French film, you're interested in the current French cinema.
Yes.
What are some of the most important issues now for French filmmakers like yourself?
How do you mean? It's among the important issues first is to have the possibility of still making film in French.
No, in French, in the
yes.
French language?
Yes, in
is
French
that,
language.
Is that in jeopardy now? What's the problem?
It's a problem. I mean, even I'm always meeting some producers who says, why don't you do that film in English? It would be better for the market.
You did one film in English, or at least one film.
Yes.
I did
Mississippi Blues. But I mean, that there was a reason behind that. And in the film, the French were speaking French.
Do you think it's getting any easier or more difficult for French filmmakers like yourself to have their films shown in the United States?
It's more difficult now.
Why is it?
It's more difficult because I think that, and I talk to a lot of film critics, I think the press is less interested by anything by foreign films. Not only by French film, by foreign films. I can see the space closing down. There are a lot of channels devoted to classic, to old films. They never take a foreign film. I feel that even that Turner Film Classic should open a little door.
I know what you mean, but on the other hand, I find it really hard to watch subtitled films on television.
I don't. I mean, a lot of people in Sweden, in Japan, in Denmark, they only see subtitled film. In England, they see a lot of subtitled film on Channel 4 and BBC, and they can. So does that mean that the Americans are less literate than all those people? I mean, I find that the cable are not giving any enough room to foreign film and I feel it's more difficult.
When you were growing up and you saw American movies, did you see them dubbed or subtitled?
With both, and sometimes there is something which I saw dubbed, which maybe I like them better dubbed than subtitled. But
Wait a minute, why?
Them both.
I always
no, that's kind of crazy film buff love. I mean, it's but most of the time when we were able to, we were seeing the film with subtitle.
It really bugs me when films are dubbed because you don't get the actor's real voice.
Yes, of course. I mean, it's but sometimes I created a film club and we decided to show dubbed version when there was no other way to see the film.
Oh, sure.
But even the first time I saw Singing in the Rain, it was in 16 millimeters, black and white, dubbed, and even the song were dubbed. So I had I had very approximative vision of the film.
What was it? Was it very surprising when you actually saw it in English and heard Gene Kelly singing instead of
it was a shock.
What was shocking?
It was so beautiful that do you imagine that MGM, a studio, was able to conceive that idea to have a film like that shown in black and white, dubbed, and with all the song being dubbed? I mean, this.
What's particularly remarkable about that is it's a movie about voices being dubbed.
Yes. It's become like now it adds another level.
It's like a funhouse mirror.
Yeah, I mean, it's you could, if you were very perverse, say that this is the ultimate version of Singing in the Rain.
You've said that when you started to make movies, that you loved American cinema so much, but when you started to make movies, you wanted to make movies that were French.
Yes.
What did that mean?
I had seen at that time many films who were derivative from the American cinema. Especially thrillers, film noir, where the cops were behaving like in an American film. The gangsters were behaving like in an American film. I saw a way of shooting too, which was American and not French. I felt that my film had to be rooted in a French context, in a French culture. They had to speak about France. I felt that I had to live with my country and not be in. You are always influenced by the great directors, but not try to imitate
them.
Or to imitate what was good in the American cinema. In the best American films, you feel the time and you feel the period. You feel the space. In the best, in the Searchers, John Ford, you cannot take the characters out of Monument Valley. They seem to be rooted there. You know what I mean? I mean, and so I wanted to have that same feeling. I wanted to get something which was the opposite. And at that time we had, and the same thing is happening now. We had films which were, and you say, it's a derivative from the American cinema. I mean, we have people trying to make. To make a copy of an American saying that it will sell more in the States. I love American directors and American cinema. I just want to be able to go on making the film I want, and I want that the other French filmmaker keep on making the film they want.
Bertrand Tavernier is touring America, screening Lumiere Brothers movies in a program called The First Picture Show. This week he'll be at the High Museum in Atlanta, the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston, and the Art Institute of Chicago. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Audrey Bentham, Chris Fraley, and Al Banks. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Make 'em laugh, make 'em laugh. Don't you know everyone wants to laugh? My dad said be an actor, my son. But be a comical one. They'll be standing in lines for those old honky-tonk monkey shines. Or you could study Shakespeare and be quite elite. And you could charm the critics and have nothing to eat. Just slip on a banana peel, the world's at your feet. Make 'em laugh, make 'em laugh, make 'em laugh. Make 'em laugh. Don't you know everyone wants to laugh? My grandpa said go out and tell 'em a joke. But give it plenty of hope. Make 'em roar, make 'em scream.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts, and by Penguin Books, publishers of Penguin Classics, for 50 years the definition of classic. Penguin Classics catalog available through email at reading@penguin.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, activist Reverend Al Sharpton. His supporters see him as giving a voice to the disenfranchised. His critics call him a loudmouthed opportunist. Also, the story of the Sarajevo Haggadah, the Passover prayer book from the 14th century, whose story parallels the story of Jewish exile. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.